away early and was out of humor, too, such must be the case. He's been so long in love, and I'm very sorry for him. So that's it. I should imagine, though, she might reckon on a better match, said Vronsky, setting his chest straight and walking about again. Though I don't know him, of course, he added. Yes, that is a hateful position. That's why most fellows prefer to have to do with the Claras. If you don't succeed with them, it only proves that you've not got enough cash. But in this case, one's dignity is in the balance. But here's the train. The engine had already whistled in the distance. A few instants later, the platform began to shake, and with puffs of steam hanging low in the air from the frost, the engine rolled up, with the rod of the middle wheel rhythmically moving up and down, and the bowed, muffled figure of the engine driver covered with hoarfrost. Behind the tender, setting the platform more and more slowly and more powerfully shaking, came the luggage van, with a dog whining in it. At last the passenger carriages rolled in, quivering before coming to a standstill. A smart guard jumped out, giving a whistle, and after him, one by one, the impatient passengers began to get down. An officer of the guards, holding himself erect and looking severely about him, a nimble young merchant with a bag, smiling gaily, a peasant with a sack over his shoulder. Vronsky, standing beside Oblonsky, watched the carriages and the passengers, totally oblivious of his mother. What he had just heard about Kitty excited and delighted him. Unconsciously, he straightened his chest and his eyes flashed. He felt himself a conqueror. Countess Vronskaya is in that compartment, said the smart guard, going up to Vronsky. The guard's words roused him and forced him to think of his mother and his approaching meeting with her. He did not in his heart respect his mother, and without acknowledging it to himself, he did not love her, though in accordance with the ideas of the set in which he lived, and with his own upbringing, he could not have conceived of any behavior to his mother not in the highest degree respectful and obedient, and the more externally obedient and respectful, the less in his heart he respected and loved her. Chapter 18. Vronsky followed the guard to the carriage, and at the door of the compartment he stopped short to make room for a lady who was getting out. With the habitual feeling of a man of the world, from one glance at his lady's appearance, Vronsky classified her as belonging to the best society. He begged pardon and was getting into the carriage, but felt he must glance at her once more, not because she was very beautiful, not because of that elegance and modest grace which were apparent in her whole figure, but because in the expression of her charming face, as she passed close by him, there was something peculiarly caressing and soft. As he looked round, she too turned her head. Her shining gray eyes that looked dark because of her thick lashes rested with friendly attention on his face, as though she were recognizing him, and then promptly turned away to the passing crowd as though seeking someone. In that brief look, Vronsky had time to notice the suppressed animation which played over her face and flitted between the brilliant eyes and the faint smile that curved her red lips. It was as though her nature were so brimming over with something that, against her will, it showed itself now in the flash of her eyes and now in her smile. Deliberately, she shrouded the light in her eyes, but it shone against her will in her faintly perceptible smile. Vronsky stepped into the carriage. His mother, a dried-up old lady with black eyes and ringlets, screwed up her eyes, scanning her son, and smiled slightly with her thin lips. Getting up from the seat and handing her maid a handbag, she gave her little wrinkled hand to her son to kiss, and lifting his head from her hand, kissed him on the cheek. You got my telegram. Quite well? Thank God. You had a good journey? Said her son, sitting down beside her, and involuntarily listening to a woman's voice outside the door. He knew it was the voice of the lady he had met at the door. All the same, I don't agree with you, said the lady's voice. It's a Peterburg view, madam. Not Peterburg, but simply feminine, she responded. Well, well, allow me to kiss your hand. Goodbye, Ivan Petrovich. And would you see if my brother is here and send him to me? Said the lady in the doorway, and stepped back again into the compartment. Well, have you found your brother? Said Countess Vronskaya, addressing the lady. Vronsky understood now that this was Madame Karenina. Your brother is here, he said, standing up. Excuse me, I did not know you. And indeed our acquaintance was so slight, said Vronsky, bowing, that no doubt you do not remember me. Oh, no, said she, I should have known you because your mother and I have been talking. I think of nothing but you all the way. As she spoke, she let the animation that would insist on coming out show itself in her smile. And still no sign of my brother. Do call him, Alyosha, said the old countess. Vronsky stepped out onto the platform and shouted, Oblonsky, here. Madame Karenina, however, did not wait for her brother, but catching sight of him, she stepped out with her light, resolute step. And as soon as her brother had reached her, with a gesture that struck Vronsky by its decision and its grace, she flung her left arm around his neck, drew him rapidly to her, and kissed him warmly. Vronsky looked on, never taking his eyes from her, and smiled. He could not have said why. But recollecting that his mother was waiting for him, he went back again into the carriage. She's very sweet, isn't she? Said the Countess of Madame Karenina. Her husband put her with me, and I was delighted to have her. We've been talking all the way. And so you, I hear, vous filez le parfum amour. Tant mieux, mon cher, tant mieux. I don't know what you are referring to, maman, he answered coldly. Come, maman, let us go. Madame Karenina entered the carriage again to say goodbye to the Countess. Well, Countess, you have met your son, and I my brother, she said gaily, and all my stories are exhausted. I should have nothing more to tell you. Oh, no, said the Countess, taking her hand. I could go all around the world with you and never be dull. You are one of those delightful women in whose company it's sweet either to be silent or to chat. Now, please don't fret over your son. You can't expect never to be parted. Madame Karenina stood quite still, holding herself very erect, and her eyes were smiling. Anna Arkadyevna, the Countess said in explanation to her son, has a little son 8 years old, I believe, and she has never been parted from him before, and she keeps fretting over leaving him. Yes, the Countess and I have been talking all the time, I of my son and she of hers, said Madame Karenina, and again a smile lighted up her face, a caressing smile intended for him. I am afraid that you must have been dreadfully bored, he said, promptly catching the ball of coquetry she had flung at him. But apparently she did not care to pursue the conversation in that strain, and she turned to the old countess. Thank you so much. The time has passed so quickly. Goodbye, countess. Goodbye, my love, answered the countess. Let me kiss your pretty face. I speak plainly at my age, and I tell you simply that I've lost my heart to you. Stereotyped as the phrase was, Madame Karenina obviously believed it was delighted by it. She flushed, bent down slightly, and put her cheek to the Countess's lips, drew herself up again, and with the same smile fluttering between her lips and her eyes, she gave her hand to Vronsky. He pressed the little hand she gave him and was delighted, as though at something special, by the energetic squeeze with which she freely and vigorously shook his hand. She went out with the rapid step which bore her rather fully developed figure with such strange lightness. Very charming, said the Countess. That was precisely what her son was thinking. His eyes followed her till her graceful figure was out of sight, and then the smile remained on his face. He saw out of the window how she went up to her brother, put her arm in his, and began telling him something animatedly, obviously something that had nothing to do with him, Vronsky. And at that he felt annoyed. Well, mamma, are you perfectly well? He repeated, returning to his mother. Everything has been delightful. Alexander has been very good, and Marie has grown very pretty. She's very interesting. And she began telling him again of what interested her most, the christening of her grandson, for which she had been staying in Petersburg, and the special favor shown her elder son by the Tsar. Here's Leventry, said Vronsky, looking out the window. Now we can go if you like. The old butler, who had traveled with the Countess, came to the carriage to announce that everything was ready, and the Countess got up to go. Come, there's not such a crowd now, said Vronsky. The maid took a handbag and the lap dog, the butler and the porter the other baggage. Vronsky gave his mother his arm, but just as they were getting out of the carriage, several men ran suddenly by with panic-stricken faces. The station master, too, ran by in his extraordinarily colored cap. Obviously, something unusual had happened. The crowd was running to the tail end of the train. What? What? Where? Flung himself? Crashed? Was heard among the crowd. Stepan Arkadyevich, with his sister on his arm, turned back. They, too, looked scared and stopped at the carriage door to avoid the crowd. The ladies got in while Vronsky and Stepan Arkadyevich followed the crowd to find out details of the disaster. A watchman, either drunk or too much muffled up in the bitter frost, had not heard the train moving back and had been crushed. Before Vronsky and Oblonsky came back, the ladies heard the facts from the butler. Oblonsky and Vronsky had both seen the mutilated corpse. Oblonsky was evidently distressed. He frowned and seemed ready to cry. Oh, how awful. Ah, Anna, if you had seen it. Ah, how awful, he kept repeating. Vronsky did not speak. His handsome face was serious, but perfectly calm. Ah, if you had seen it, Countess, said Stepan Arkadyevich. And his wife was there. It was awful to see her. She flung herself on the body. They say he was the only support of an immense family. How awful. Couldn't one do anything for her, said Madame Karenina in an agitated whisper. Vronsky glanced at her and immediately got out of the carriage. I'll be back directly, Mama, he remarked, turning around in the doorway. When he came back a few minutes later, Stepan Arkadyevich was already in conversation with the Countess about a new singer while she was impatiently looking toward the door waiting for her son. Now let us be off, said Vronsky, coming in. They went out together. Vronsky was in front of his mother. Behind walked Madame Karenina with her brother. Just as they were going out of the station master overtook Vronsky. You gave my assistant 200 rubles. Would you kindly explain for whose benefit you intend them? For the widow, said Vronsky, shrugging his shoulders. I should have thought there was no need to ask. You gave that? Cried Oblonsky behind, and pressing his sister's hand, he added, most charming, most charming. Isn't he a fine fellow? Goodbye, Countess. And he and his sister stood still, looking for her maid. When they went out, the Vronsky's carriage had already driven away. People coming in were still talking of what had happened. What a horrible death, said a gentleman passing by. They say he was cut in two. On the contrary, I think it's the easiest, instantaneous, observed another. How is it they don't take proper precautions, the third was saying. Madame Karenina seated herself in the carriage, and Stepan Arkadyevich saw with surprise that her lips were quivering, and that she was, with difficulty, restraining her tears. What is it, Anna? He asked when they had driven a few hundred stages. It's an omen of evil, she said. What nonsense, said Stepan Arkadyevich. You've come, that's the chief thing. You can't conceive how I'm resting my hopes on you. Have you known Vronsky long, she asked. Yes, you know we're hoping he will marry Kitty. Yes, said Anna softly. Come now, let us talk of you, she added, tossing her head as though she would physically shake off something superfluous suppressed in her. Let us talk of your affairs. I got your letter, and here I am. Yes, all my hopes are in you, said Stepan Arkadyevich. Well, tell me all about it. And Stepan Arkadyevich began his story. On reaching home, Oblonsky helped his sister out, sighed, pressed her hand, and set off to his office. Chapter 19. When Anna entered the tiny dining room, she found Dolly sitting there with a white-headed, plump little boy, already resembling his father. She was listening to a lesson in French reading. As the boy read, he kept twisting and trying to tear off a button that was nearly off his jacket. His mother had several times taken his hand from it, but the plump little hand went back to the button again. His mother pulled the button off and put it in her pocket. Keep your hands still, Grisha, she said, and she took up her work, a coverlet she had long been making. She always set to work on it at depressed moments, and now she knitted at it nervously, twitching her fingers and counting the stitches. Though she had sent word the day before to her husband that it was nothing to her whether his sister came or not, she had made everything ready for her arrival and was expecting her sister-in-law with agitation. Dolly was crushed by her sorrow, utterly swallowed up by it. Still, she did not forget that Anna, her sister-in-law, was the wife of one of the most important personages in Petersburg, and was a Petersburg grand dame. And thanks to this circumstance, she did not carry out her threat to her husband. That is to say, she had not forgotten that her sister-in-law was coming. And, after all, Anna is in no wise to blame, thought Dolly. I know nothing save the very best about her, and I have seen nothing but kindness and affection from her toward myself. It was true that as far as she could recall her impressions at Peterburg at the Karenins, she did not like their household itself. There was something artificial about the whole arrangement of their family. But why should I not receive her? If only she doesn't take it into her head to console me, thought Dolly. All consolations and exhortations and Christian forgiveness, I have thought all this over 1,000 times, and it's all no use. All these days Dolly had been alone with her children. She did not want to talk of her sorrow, but with that sorrow in her heart, she could not talk of outside matters. She knew that in one way or another, she would tell Anna everything, and she was alternately glad at the thought of speaking freely, and angry at the necessity of speaking of her humiliation with her, his sister, and of hearing her ready-made phrases of exhortation and consolation. She had been on the lookout for her, glancing at her watch every minute, and as often happens, let slip that precise minute when her visitor arrived, so that she did not hear the bell. Catching the sound of skirts and of light steps at the door, she looked round, and her careworn face unconsciously expressed not gladness but wonder. She got up and embraced her sister-in-law. "What, here already?" she said as she kissed her. "Dolly, how glad I am to see you." "I am glad, too," said Dolly, faintly smiling, and trying by the expression of Anna's face to find out whether she knew. "Most likely she knows," she thought, noticing the sympathy in Anna's face. "Well, come along, I'll take you to your room," she went on, trying to defer as long as possible the time of explanation. "Is this Grisha?" "Heavens, how he's grown," said Anna, and kissing him, never taking her eyes off Dolly, she stood still and flushed. "No, please, let us stay here." She took off her shawl and her hat, and catching it in a lock of her black hair, which was a mass of curls, she tossed her head and shook her hair down. "You are radiant with health and happiness," said Dolly, almost with envy. Yes, said Anna. "Merciful heavens, Tanya, you're the same age as my Seriosha," she added, addressing the little girl as she ran in. She took her in her arms and kissed her. "Delightful child, delightful. Show me them all." She mentioned them, not only remembering the names, but the years, months, characters, illnesses of all the children, and Dolly could not but appreciate that. "Very well, we will go to them," she said. "It's a pity Vasya is asleep." After seeing the children, they sat down alone now in the drawing room to coffee. Anna took the tray and then pushed it away from her. "Dolly," she said, "he has told me." Dolly looked coldly at Anna. She was waiting now for hypocritically sympathetic phrases, but Anna said nothing of the sort. "Dolly, darling," she said, "I don't want to intercede for him, nor to try to comfort you. That's impossible. But, my dearest, I'm simply sorry, sorry from my heart for you." Under the thick lashes of her shining eyes, tears suddenly glittered. She moved nearer to her sister-in-law and took her hand in her own, vigorous and little. Dolly did not shrink away, but her face did not lose its frigid expression. She said, "To comfort me is impossible. Everything's lost after what has happened. Everything's over." And directly she had said this, her face suddenly softened. Anna lifted the wasted, thin hand of Dolly, kissed it, and said, "But, Dolly, what's to be done? What's to be done? How is it best to act in this awful position? That's what you must think of." "All's over, and there's nothing more," said Dolly. "And the worst of it all is, you see, that I can't cast him off. There are the children. My hands are tied. And I can't live with him. It's a torture for me to see him." "Dolly, darling, he has spoken to me, but I want to hear it from you. Tell me all about it." Dolly looked at her inquiringly. Sympathy and love unfeigned were apparent on Anna's face. "Very well," she suddenly said, "but I will begin at the beginning. You know how I was married. With the education Maman gave us, I was more than innocent. I was foolish. I knew nothing. They say, I know. Men tell their wives of their former lives. But Stiva," she corrected herself, "Stepan Arkadyevich told me nothing. You'll hardly believe it, but till now I imagined that I was the only woman he had known. So I lived 8 years. You must understand that I was not only far from suspecting infidelity, but I regarded it as impossible, and then, try to imagine it, with such conceptions to find out suddenly all the horror, all the loathsomeness, you must try and understand me. To be fully convinced of one's happiness, and all at once, continued Dolly, holding back her sobs, to get a letter, his letter to his mistress, a governess in my employ. No, it's too awful. She hastily pulled out her handkerchief and hid her face in it. I can understand if it were passion, she went on after a brief silence, but to deceive me deliberately, slyly, and with whom? To go on being my husband while he and she, it's awful. You can't understand. Oh, yes, I understand. I understand. Dolly, dearest, I do understand, said Anna, pressing her hand. And do you imagine he realizes all the awfulness of my position? Dolly resumed. Not in the slightest. He's happy and contented. Oh, no, Anna interposed quickly. He's to be pitied. He's weighed down by remorse. Is he capable of remorse? Dolly interrupted, gazing intently into her sister-in-law's face. Yes, I know him. I could not look at him without feeling sorry for him. We both know him. He's good-natured, but he's proud, and now he's so humiliated. What touched me most, and here Anna guessed what would touch Dolly most, he's tortured by two things, that he's ashamed for the children's sake, and that, loving you, yes, yes, loving you beyond everything on earth, she hurriedly interrupted Dolly, who would have rejoined, he has hurt you, pierced you to the heart. No, no, she cannot forgive me, he keeps on saying. Dolly looked pensively past her sister-in-law as she listened to her words. Yes, I can see that his position is awful. It's worse for the guilty than the innocent, he said, if he feels that all the misery comes from his fault. But how am I to forgive him? How am I to be his wife again after her? For me to live with him now would be torture, just because I love my past love for him. The sobs cut short her words. But as though of set design, each time she was softened, she began to speak again of what exasperated her. She's young, you see. She's pretty, she went on. Do you know, Anna, my youth and my beauty are gone. Taken by whom? By him and his children. I have worked for him, and all I had has gone in his service. And now, of course, any fresh, vulgar creature has more charm for him. No doubt they talked of me together, or worse still, they were silent about me. You understand? Again her eyes glowed with hatred. And after that he will tell me, what? Am I to believe him? Never. No, everything is over. Everything that once constituted my comfort and reward of my work and of my sufferings. Would you believe it? I was teaching Grisha just now. Once this was a joy to me. Now it is a torture. What have I to strive and toil for? Why to have children? What's so awful is that all at once my heart's turned, and instead of love and tenderness, I have nothing but hatred for him. Yes, hatred. I could kill him and... Darling Dolly, I understand, but don't torture yourself. You are so insulted, so excited, that you look at many things mistakenly. Dolly grew calmer, and for 2 minutes both were silent. What's to be done? Think for me, Anna. Help me. I have thought over everything, and I see nothing. Anna could not find anything, but her heart echoed instantly to each word, to each change of expression on her sister-in-law's face. One thing I would say, began Anna, I am his sister. I know his character, that faculty of forgetting everything. Everything, she waved her hand before her forehead, that faculty for being completely carried away, but for completely repenting, too. He cannot believe it. He cannot comprehend now how he could have acted as he did. No, he understands and understood, Dolly broke in. But you are forgetting me. Does that make it easier for me? Wait a minute. When he told me, I will own I did not realize all the horror of your position. I saw nothing but him and that the family was broken up. I felt sorry for him, but after talking to you, I see it as a woman quite differently. I see your agony, and I can't tell you how sorry I am for you. But, Dolly, darling, while I fully realize your suffering, there is one thing I don't know. I don't know how much love there is still in your heart for him. That you know, whether there is enough for you to be able to forgive him. If there is, forgive him. No, Dolly was beginning, but Anna cut her short, kissing her hand once more. I know more of the world than you do, she said. I know how men like Stiva look at it. You speak of his talking of you with her. That never happened. Such men are unfaithful, but their own home and wife are sacred to them. Somehow or other, these women are still looked on with contempt by them and do not touch on their feeling for their family. They draw a sort of line that can't be crossed between them and their families. I don't understand it, but it is so. Yes, but he has kissed her. Dolly, hush, darling. I saw Stiva when he was in love with you. I remember the time when he came to me and cried, talking of you, and of what a poetry and loftiness you were for him. And I know that the longer he has lived with you, the loftier you have been in his eyes. You know, we have sometimes laughed at him for putting in at every word. Dolly's a marvelous woman. Have always been a divinity for him, and you are that still, and this has not been a passion of the heart. But if it be repeated? It cannot be, as I understand it. Yes, but could you forgive it? I don't know. I can't judge. No, I can judge, said Anna, thinking a moment, and grasping the position in her thought and weighing it in her inner balance, she said, yes, I can. I can. I can. Yes, I could forgive. I could not be the same, no, but I could forgive, and forgive as though it had never been, never been at all. Oh, of course, Dolly interposed quickly, as though saying what she had more than once thought, else it would not be forgiveness. If one forgives, it must be completely, completely. Come, let us go. I'll take you to your room, she said, getting up, and on the way she embraced Anna. My dear, how glad I am you came. It has made things better, ever so much better. Chapter 20. The whole of that day Anna spent at home, that is, at the Oblonskys, and received no one, though some of her acquaintances had already heard of her arrival and came to call the same day. Anna spent the whole morning with Dolly and the children. She merely sent a brief note to her brother to tell him that he must not fail to dine at home. Come, God is merciful, she wrote. Oblonsky did dine at home. The conversation was general, and his wife, speaking to him, addressed him as Stiva, as she had not done for some time past. In the relations of husband and wife, the same estrangement still remained, but there was no talk of separation, and Stepan Arkadyevitch saw the possibility of explanation and reconciliation. Immediately after dinner, Kitty came in. She knew Anna Arkadyevna, but only very slightly, and she came now to her sisters with some trepidation at the prospect of meeting this fashionable Petersburg lady of whom everyone spoke so highly. But she made a favorable impression on Anna Arkadyevna, and she perceived that at once. Anna was unmistakably admiring her loveliness and her youth. Before Kitty knew where she was, she found herself not merely under Anna's sway, but in love with her, as young girls do fall in love with older and married women. Anna did not resemble a fashionable lady or the mother of a boy 8 years old. In the elasticity of her movements, the freshness and the animation which persisted in her face and broke out in her smile and her glance, she would rather have passed for a girl of 20, had it not been for a serious and at times a mournful look in her eyes, which struck and attracted Kitty. Kitty felt that Anna was perfectly simple and was concealing nothing, but that she had another higher world of interests, complex and poetic, which were inaccessible to Kitty. After dinner, when Dolly withdrew to her own room, Anna rose quickly and went up to her brother, who was just lighting a cigar. Stiva, she said to him, winking gaily, making the sign of the cross over him, and glancing toward the door. Go, and God help you. He tossed away his cigar, having understood her, and departed through the doorway. When Stepan Arkadyevitch had disappeared, she went back to the sofa where she had been sitting, surrounded by the children. Either because the children saw that their mother was fond of this aunt, or that they themselves sensed a special charm in her, the two elder ones and the younger, following their lead, as children so often do, had clung about their new aunt since before dinner and would not leave her side. And it had become a sort of game among them to sit as close as possible to their aunt, to touch her, hold her little hand, kiss it, play with her ring, or even touch the flounce of her skirt. Come, come, as we were sitting before, said Anna Arkadyevna, sitting down in her place, And again Grisha poked his little face under her arm and nestled with his head on her gown, beaming with pride and happiness. "And when is your next ball?" she asked Kitty. "Next week, in a splendid ball, one of those balls where one always enjoys oneself." "Why, are there balls where one always enjoys oneself?" Anna said with tender irony. "It's strange, but there are. At the Bobrishevs, one always enjoys oneself, and at the Nikitins, too, while at the Meshkovs, it's always dull. Haven't you noticed it?" "No, my dear, for me there are no balls now where one enjoys oneself," said Anna, and Kitty detected in her eyes that peculiar world which was not revealed to her. "For me, there are some which are less dull and tiresome than others." "How can you be dull at a ball?" "Why should not I be dull at a ball?" inquired Anna. Kitty perceived that Anna knew what answer would follow. "Because you always look the loveliest of all." Anna had the faculty of blushing. She blushed and said, "In the first place, it's never so, and secondly, if it were, what difference would it make to me?" "Are you coming to this ball?" asked Kitty. "I imagine it won't be possible to avoid going. Here, take it," she said to Tanya, who was pulling the loosely fitting ring off her white slender tipped finger. "I shall be so glad if you go. I should so like to see you at a ball. Anyway, if I do go, I shall comfort myself with the thought that it's a pleasure to you. Grisha, don't pull my hair. It's untidy enough without that," she said, putting up a straying lock, which Grisha had been playing with. "I imagine you at the ball in lilac." "And why in lilac, precisely?" asked Anna, smiling. "Now, children, run along, run along. Do you hear? Miss Hooley is calling you to tea," she said, tearing the children from her and sending them off to the dining room. "I know why you pressed me to come to the ball. You expect a great deal of this ball, and you want everyone to be there and take part in it." "How do you know?" "Yes? Oh, what a happy time you are at," pursued Anna. "I remember, and I know this blue haze, like the mist on the mountains in Switzerland. This mist which covers everything in that blissful time when childhood is just ending, and out of that vast circle, happy and gay, there is a path growing narrower and narrower, and it is delightful and alarming to enter the ballroom, bright and splendid as it is. Who has not been through it?" Kitty smiled without speaking. "But how did she go through it? How I should like to know all her love story," thought Kitty, recalling the unromantic appearance of Alexei Alexandrovich, her husband. "I know something. Stiva told me, and I congratulate you. I like him so much," Anna continued. "I met Vronsky at the railway station." "Oh, was he there?" asked Kitty, blushing. "What was it Stiva told you?" "Stiva blabbed about it all, and I should be so glad. I traveled yesterday with Vronsky's mother," she went on, "and his mother talked without a pause of him. He's her favorite. I know mothers are partial, but..." "What did his mother tell you?" "Oh, a great deal, and although I know that he's her favorite, one can still see how chivalrous he is. Well, for instance, she told me that he had wanted to give up all his property to his brother, that he had done something extraordinary when he was quite a child, saved a woman from the water. He's a hero, in fact," said Anna, smiling and recollecting the 200 rubles he had given at the station. But she did not tell Kitty about the 200 rubles. For some reason, it was disagreeable to her to think of it. She felt that there was something that had to do with her in it, and something that ought not to have been. "She pressed me very much to go and see her," Anna went on, "and I shall be glad to see her tomorrow. Stiva is staying a long while in Dolly's room. Thank God," Anna added, changing the subject and getting up. Kitty fancied, displeased with something. "No, I'm first. No, I," screamed the children, who had finished tea, running up to their Aunt Anna. "All together," said Anna, and she ran laughing to meet them, and embracing them threw all the children, shrieking with delight, into a swarming heap. Chapter 21. Dolly came out of her room to the tea of the grown-ups. Stepan Arkadyevich did not come out. He must have left his wife's room by a back door. "I am afraid you'll be cold upstairs," observed Dolly, addressing Anna. "I want to move you downstairs, and we shall be nearer." "Oh, please don't trouble about me," answered Anna, looking intently into Dolly's face, trying to make out whether there had been a reconciliation or not. "It will be lighter for you here," answered her sister-in-law. "I assure you that I can sleep like a marmot anywhere and any time." "What's all this?" inquired Stepan Arkadyevich, coming out of his room and addressing his wife. From his tone, both Kitty and Anna at once gathered that a reconciliation had taken place. I want to move Anna downstairs, but we must hang up blinds. No one knows how to do it. I must see to it myself, answered Dolly, addressing him. God knows whether they are fully reconciled, thought Anna, hearing her tone cold and composed. Come, Dolly, why be always making difficulties, answered her husband. There, I'll do it all if you like. I know how you do everything, answered Dolly. You tell Nat V to do what can't be done, and go away yourself, leaving him to make a muddle of everything. And her habitual mocking smile curved the corner of Dolly's lips as she spoke. Full reconciliation, full, thought Anna, thank God. And rejoicing that she was the cause of it, she went up to Dolly and kissed her. Not at all. Why do you always look down at me and Matthew, said Stepan Arkadyevitch, smiling hardly perceptibly and addressing his wife. The whole evening Dolly was, as always, a little mocking in her tone to her husband. While Stepan Arkadyevitch was happy and cheerful, yet not so as to seem as if, having been forgiven, he had forgotten his fault. At 9:30 a particularly joyful and pleasant family conversation over the tea-table at the Oblonskys' was broken up by an apparently simple incident. But this simple incident, for some reason, struck everyone as strange. Having begun talking about common acquaintances in Petersburg, Anna got up quickly. She is in my album, she said, and by the way, I'll show you my Seryozha, she added with a mother's smile of pride. Toward 10:00, when she usually said goodnight to her son and often, before going to a ball, put him to bed herself, she felt depressed at being so far from him, and whatever she was talking about, she kept coming back in thought to her curly-headed Seryozha. She longed to look at his photograph and talk of him. Seizing the first pretext, she got up and with her light, resolute step went for her album. The stairs up to her room came out on the landing of the great, warm main staircase. Just as she was leaving the drawing room, a ring was heard in the hall. Who can that be? Said Dolly. It's too early for me to be fetched, and for anyone else, it's too late, observed Kitty. It's sure to be someone with papers for me, put in Stepan Arkadyevitch. When Anna was passing the top of the staircase, a servant was running up to announce the visitor, while the visitor himself was standing under a lamp. Anna, glancing down, at once recognized Vronsky, and a strange feeling of pleasure and at the same time of some dread stirred in her heart. He stood there without taking off his coat and pulling something out of his pocket. At the instant when she was just halfway up the stairs, he raised his eyes, caught sight of her, and the expression of his face changed to embarrassment and dismay. With a slight inclination of her head, she passed, hearing behind her Stepan Arkadyevitch's loud voice calling him to come up, and the quiet, soft, and calm voice of Vronsky refusing. When Anna returned with the album, he was already gone, and Stepan Arkadyevitch was telling them that he had called to inquire about the dinner they were giving next day to a foreign celebrity. And nothing would induce him to come up. What a queer fellow he is, added Stepan Arkadyevitch. Kitty blushed. She thought that she was the only person who knew why he had come and why he would not come up. He has been at home, she thought, and didn't find me, and thought I should be here. But he did not come up because he thought it late, and Anna's here. All of them looked at each other, saying nothing, and began to look at Anna's album. There was nothing either exceptional or strange in a man's calling at 9:30 on a friend to inquire details of a proposed dinner party and not coming in. Yet it seemed strange to all of them, and to Anna it seemed stranger and more unpleasant than to any of the others. The ball was only just beginning as Kitty and her mother walked up the great staircase, flooded with light and lined with flowers and footmen in powder and red coats. From the rooms came a constant, steady noise, like that of a hive, a swarm. And as they were giving the final little touches to hair and dresses before a mirror on the landing between potted trees, they heard, coming from the ballroom, the gently distinct notes of the fiddles of the orchestra beginning the first waltz. A little ancient in civilian dress, arranging his gray curls before another mirror and diffusing an odor of scent, stumbled against them on the stairs and stood aside, evidently admiring Kitty, whom he did not know. A beardless youth, one of those society youths whom the old Prince Shcherbatsky calls whelps, in an exceedingly open waistcoat, straightening his white tie as he went, bowed to them, and after running by, came back to ask Kitty for a quadrille. As the first quadrille had already been given to Vronsky, she had to promise this youth the second. An officer, buttoning his gloves, stood aside in the doorway, and stroking his mustache, admired the rosy Kitty. Although her dress, her coiffure, and all the preparations for the ball had cost Kitty much trouble and planning, at this moment she walked into the ballroom in the elaborate tulle dress, over a pink slip, as unconcernedly and simply as though all the rosettes and lace, all the minute details of her attire, had not cost her or her family a moment's attention. As though she had been born in this tulle and lace, with its towering coiffure, surmounted by a rose and two small leaves. When, just before entering the ballroom, the old princess tried to adjust a sash ribbon that had become twisted, Kitty had drawn back a little. She felt that everything must be right of itself and graceful, and that nothing could need setting straight. Kitty had one of her good days. Her dress was not uncomfortable anywhere. Her lace bertha did not droop anywhere. Her rosettes were neither crushed nor torn off. Her pink slippers with high, curving heels did not pinch, but gladdened her tiny feet. And the thick bandeau of fair hair kept up on her head. All the three buttons buttoned up without tearing on the long glove that covered her hand without concealing its lines. The black velvet ribbon of her locket nestled with special tenderness round her neck. This velvet ribbon was a darling. At home, regarding her neck in the looking glass, Kitty had felt that velvet was speaking. About all the rest, there might be a doubt, but the velvet ribbon was a darling. Kitty smiled here, too, at the ball, when she glanced at it in the glass. Her bare shoulders and arms gave Kitty a sensation of chill marble, a sensation she particularly liked. Her eyes sparkled, and her rosy lips could not help but smile from the consciousness of their own attractiveness. She had scarcely entered the ballroom and reached the tulle, ribbon, lace-colored throng of ladies waiting to be asked to dance. Kitty was never one of that throng. When she was asked for a waltz and asked by the best partner, the first star in the hierarchy of the ballroom, a renowned conductor of the dances and master of ceremonies, married man, handsome, and well-built, Egorushka Korsunsky. He had only just left the Countess Vanina, with whom he had danced the first turn of the waltz, and scanning his demands, that is to say, a few couples who had started dancing, he caught sight of Kitty entering, and flew up to her with that peculiar, easy amble which is confined to conductors of the dances. Bowing, and without even asking her if she cared to dance, he put out his arm to encircle her slender waist. She looked round for someone to give her fan to, and their hostess, smiling to her, took it. "How good of you to come in good time," he said to her, embracing her waist. "Such a bad habit to be late." Bending her left arm, she laid it on his shoulder, and her little feet in her pink slippers began swiftly, lightly, and rhythmically moving over the slippery floor in time to the music. "It's a rest to waltz with you," he said to her as they fell into the first slow steps of the waltz. "It's charming. Such lightness, precision." He said to her the same thing he said to almost all his partners, whom he knew well. She smiled at his praise and continued to look about the room over his shoulder. She was not like a girl at her first ball, for whom all faces in the ballroom melt into one vision of fairyland. And she was not a girl who had gone the stale round of balls till every face in the ballroom was familiar and tiresome. But she was in the middle stage between these two. She was excited, and at the same time she had sufficient self-possession to be able to observe. In the left corner of the ballroom she saw the very flower of society grouped together. There, impossibly naked, was the beauty, Liddy, Kerensky's wife. There was the lady of the house. There shone the bald pate of Kriven, always to be found wherever the best people were. In that direction gazed the young men, not venturing to approach. There, too, she descried Stiva, and there she saw the charming figure and head of Anna in a black velvet gown. And he was there. Kitty had not seen him since the evening she refused Levin. With her far-sighted eyes, knew him at once and was even aware that he was looking at her. "Another turn, eh? You're not tired?" said Kerensky, a little out of breath. "No, thank you. Where shall I take you?" "Madame Karenin is here, I think. Take me to her, wherever you command. And Krasinski began waltzing with measured steps straight toward the group in the left corner, continually saying, "Pardon, mesdames, pardon, pardon, madames," and steering his course through the sea of lace, tulle, and ribbon, and not disarranging a feather, he turned his partner sharply round so that her slim ankles in light, transparent stockings were exposed to view, and her train floated out in fan shape and covered Kriven's knees. Krasinski bowed, set straight his open shirt front, and gave her his arm to conduct her to Anna Arkadyevna. Kitty, flushed, took her train from Kriven's knees, and a little giddy, looked round, seeking Anna. Anna was not in lilac, as Kitty had so urgently wished, but in a black, low-cut velvet gown, showing her full shoulders and bosom, that looked as though carved in old ivory, and her rounded arms with tiny slender hands. The whole gown was trimmed with Venetian guipure. On her head, among her black hair, her own with no false additions, was a little wreath of pansies, and a similar one on the black ribbon of her sash, among white lace. Her coiffure was not striking. All that was noticeable was the little willful tendrils of her curly hair that persisted in escaping on the nape of her neck and on her temples. Encircling her sculptured strong neck was a thread of pearls. Kitty had been seeing Anna every day. She adored her and had pictured her invariably in lilac. But now, seeing her in black, she felt that she had not fully perceived her charm. She saw her now as someone quite new and surprising to her. Now she understood that Anna could not have been in lilac, and that her charm was precisely in that she always stood out against her attire, that her dress could never be noticeable on her. And her black dress with its sumptuous lace was not noticeable on her. It was only the frame, and all that was seen was she, simple, natural, elegant, and at the same time gay and animated. She was standing, as always, very erect, and when Kitty drew near the group, she was speaking to the master of the house, her head slightly turned toward him. "No, I won't cast a stone," she was saying in answer to something, "though I can't understand it," she went on, shrugging her shoulders, and she turned at once with a soft smile of protection toward Kitty. With a cursory feminine glance, she scanned her attire and made a movement of her head, hardly perceptible, but understood by Kitty, signifying approval of her dress and her looks. "You came into the room dancing," she added. "This is one of my most faithful supporters," said Krasinski, bowing to Anna Arkadyevna, whom he had not yet seen. "The princess helps to make any ball festive and successful." "Anna Arkadyevna, a waltz?" he said, bending down to her. "Why, have you met?" inquired their host. "Is there anyone we have not met? My wife and I are like white wolves. Everyone knows us," answered Krasinski. "A waltz, Anna Arkadyevna?" "I don't dance whenever it's possible not to," she said. "But tonight it's impossible," answered Krasinski. During the conversation, Vronsky was approaching them. "Well, since it's impossible tonight, let us start," she said, not noticing Vronsky's bow, and hastily put her hand on Krasinski's shoulder. What is she vexed about with him, thought Kitty, discerning that Anna had intentionally not responded to Vronsky's bow. Vronsky went up to Kitty, reminding her of the first quadrille, and expressing his regret at not having seen her all this time. Kitty gazed in admiration at Anna waltzing as she listened to him. She expected him to ask her for a waltz, but he did not, and she glanced wonderingly at him. He flushed and hurriedly asked her to waltz, but he had barely put his arm around her slender waist and taken the first step when the music suddenly stopped. Kitty looked into his face, which was so close to her own, and long afterward, for several years, this look, full of love, to which he made no response, cut her to the heart with an agony of shame. "Pardon, pardon, waltz, waltz," shouted Krasinski from the other side of the room, and seizing the first young lady he came across, he began dancing. Chapter 23. Vronsky and Kitty waltzed several times round the room. After the waltz, Kitty went to her mother, and she had hardly time to say a few words to Countess Nordstone when Vronsky came up again for the first quadrille. During the quadrille, nothing of any significance was said. There was disjointed talk between them of the Korsunskys, husband and wife, whom he described very amusingly as delightful children at 40, and of the future popular theater. And only once did the conversation touch her to the quick, when he asked her whether Levin was here, and added that he liked him very much. But Kitty did not expect much from the quadrille. She looked forward with a sinking heart to the mazurka. She fancied that the mazurka would decide everything. The fact that he did not, during the quadrille, ask her for the mazurka did not trouble her. She felt sure she would dance it with him, as she had done at former balls, and refused 5 young men, saying she was engaged for the mazurka. The whole ball, up to the last quadrille, was for Kitty an enchanted vision of delightful colors, sounds, and motions. She only sat down when she felt too tired and begged for a rest. But as she was dancing the last quadrille with one of the tiresome young men whom she could not refuse, she chanced to be vis-a-vis with Vronsky and Anna. She had not been near Anna since the beginning of the evening, and now she again suddenly saw her as quite new and surprising. She saw in her the signs of that excitement of success she knew so well in herself. She saw that she was intoxicated with the delighted admiration she was exciting. She knew that feeling and knew its signs and saw them in Anna, saw the quivering, flashing light in her eyes and the smile of happiness and excitement, unconsciously curving her lips, and the distinct grace, precision, and lightness of her movements. "Who is it?" she asked herself. "All or one?" And without keeping up her end of the conversation, the thread of which the harassed young man she was dancing with lost and could not pick up again, she obeyed with external liveliness and peremptory shouts of Korsunsky, starting them all into the grand ronde, and then into the chain, and at the same time she kept watch with a growing pain at her heart. No, it's not admiration of the crowd that has intoxicated her, but the adoration of one. And that one, can it be he? Every time he spoke to Anna, the joyous light flashed into her eyes and the smile of happiness curved her red lips. She seemed to make an effort to control herself in order not to show these signs of delight, but they appeared on her face of themselves. But what of him? Kitty looked at him and was horrified. What was pictured so clearly to Kitty in the mirror of Anna's face she saw in him? What had become of his always calm, firm manner and the carelessly calm expression of his face? Now every time he turned to her he bent his head, as though he would have fallen at her feet, and in his eyes there was nothing but humble submission and dread. "I would not offend you," his eyes seemed to be saying each time, "but I want to save myself, and I don't know how." On his face was a look such as Kitty had never seen before. They were speaking of common acquaintances, keeping up the smallest of small talk, but to Kitty it seemed that every word they said was determining their fate and hers. And strangely enough, although they were actually talking of how absurd Ivan Ivanovich was with his French, and how the Eletsky girl might have made a better match, these words were yet fraught with significance for them, and they sensed this as much as Kitty did. The whole ball, the whole world, everything seemed screened by a fog within Kitty's soul. Nothing but the stern discipline of her bringing up supported her and forced her to do what was expected of her. That is, to dance, to answer questions, to talk, even to smile. But before the mazurka, when they were beginning to rearrange the chairs, and a few couples moved out of the smaller rooms into the big room, a moment of despair and horror came for Kitty. She had refused 5 partners, and now she was not dancing the mazurka. She had not even a hope of being asked for it, because she was so successful in society that the idea would never occur to anyone that she had remained disengaged till now. She would have to tell her mother she felt ill and go home, yet she had not the strength to do this. She felt crushed. She went to the farthest end of the second drawing room and sank into a low chair. Her light, transparent skirts rose like a cloud about her slender waist. One bare, thin, soft, girlish arm, hanging listlessly, was lost in the folds of her pink tunic. In the other she held her fan and with rapid short strokes fanned her burning face. Yet, while she looked like a butterfly clinging to a blade of grass and just about to open its rainbow wings for fresh flight, Her heart ached with a horrible despair. But perhaps I am wrong. Perhaps it was not so. And again she recalled all she had seen. Kitty, what is it? Said Countess Nordstone, stepping noiselessly over the carpet toward her. I don't understand it. Kitty's lower lip began to quiver. She got up quickly. Kitty, you're not dancing the mazurka? No, no, said Kitty in a voice shaking with tears. He asked her for the mazurka in my presence, said Countess Nordstone, knowing Kitty would understand who he and her were. She said, why aren't you going to dance it with Princess Shcherbatskaya? Oh, it doesn't matter to me, answered Kitty. No one but she herself understood her position. No one knew that she had refused yesterday the man whom perhaps she loved, and refused him because she had put her faith in another. Countess Nordstone found Korsunsky, with whom she was to dance the mazurka, and told him to ask Kitty. Kitty danced in the first couple, and luckily for her, she had not to talk, because Korsunsky was all the time running about, overseeing his demands. Vronsky and Anna were sitting almost opposite her. She saw them with her far-sighted eyes, and saw them, too, close by when they met in the figures, and the more she saw of them, the more convinced was she that her unhappiness was consummated. She saw that they felt themselves alone in this crowded room, and on Vronsky's face, always so firm and independent, she saw the look that had struck her, of bewilderment and humble submissiveness, like the expression of an intelligent dog when it has done wrong. Anna smiled, and her smile was reflected by him. She grew thoughtful, and he became serious. Some supernatural force drew Kitty's eyes to Anna's face. She was charming in her simple black dress. Charming were her round arms with their bracelets. Charming was her firm neck with its thread of pearls. Charming the straying curls of her loose hair. Charming the graceful, light movements of her little feet and hands. Charming was that lovely face in its animation. Yet there was something terrible and cruel in her charm. Kitty admired her more than ever, and more acute did her suffering grow. Kitty felt crushed, and her face showed it. When Vronsky caught sight of her coming upon her in the mazurka, he did not at once recognize her, so changed was she. Delightful ball, he said to her, merely for the sake of saying something. Yes, she answered. In the middle of the mazurka, repeating a complicated figure newly invented by Korsunsky, Anna came forward into the center of the circle, chose two gentlemen, and summoned Kitty and another lady. Kitty gazed at her in dismay as she went up. Anna looked at her with drooping eyelids and smiled, pressing her hand. But noticing that Kitty only responded to her smile by a look of despair and amazement, she turned away from her and began gaily talking to the other lady. Yes, there is something uncanny, devilish, and charming about her, said Kitty to herself. Anna did not want to stay for supper, but the master of the house began urging her. Nonsense, Anna Arkadyevna, said Korsunsky, placing her bare hand upon his coat sleeve. I've such an idea for a cotillion. Un bijou. And he moved gradually on, trying to draw her along with him. Their host smiled approvingly. No, I'm not going to stay, answered Anna, smiling, but in spite of her smile, both Korsunsky and the master of the house saw from her resolute tone that she would not stay. No, why, as it is, I have danced more at your ball in Moscow than I have all the winter in Petersburg, said Anna, looking round at Vronsky, who stood near her. I must rest a little before my journey. Are you definitely going tomorrow, then? Asked Vronsky. Yes, I suppose so, answered Anna, as though wondering at the boldness of his question. But the irrepressible, quivering brilliance of her eyes and her smile set him on fire as she said it. Anna Arkadyevna did not stay to supper, but went home. Chapter 24. Yes, there must be something disgusting, repulsive about me, reflected Levin as he left the Shcherbatskys and set out on foot for his brother's lodgings. And I don't get on with other people. Pride, they say. No, I haven't even pride. If I had any pride, I should not have put myself in such a position. And he pictured to himself Vronsky, happy, good-natured, clever, and calm, certainly never placed in the awful position in which he had been that evening. Yes, she was bound to choose him. It must be so. and I cannot complain of anyone or anything. I am myself to blame. What right had I to imagine she would care to join her life to mine? Who am I, and what am I? A nobody, not wanted by anyone, nor of use to anybody. And he recalled his brother Nikolai and dwelt with pleasure on the thought of him. Isn't he right in saying that everything in the world is bad and vile? And are we fair in our judgment, present and past, of Brother Nikolai? Of course, from the point of view of Prokofy, seeing him in a torn coat and tipsy, he's a despicable person. But I know him differently. I know his soul and know what we are alike. And I, instead of going to seek him out, went out to dinner and then came here. Levin walked up to a lamppost, read his brother's address, which was in his pocketbook, and called a cabbie. All the long way to his brother's, Levin vividly recalled all the facts familiar to him of his brother Nikolai's life. He remembered how his brother, while at the university and for a year afterward, had, in spite of the jeers of his companions, lived like a monk, strictly observing all religious rites, services, and fasts, and avoiding every sort of pleasure, especially women. And now, afterward, he had all at once broken out, had associated with the most horrible people, and rushed into the most senseless debauchery. He remembered later the scandal over a boy whom he had taken from the country to bring up, and in a fit of rage had so violently beaten that proceedings were brought against him for personal injury. Then he remembered the scandal with a sharper to whom he had lost money and given a promissory note, and against whom he had himself lodged a complaint, asserting that he had cheated him. This was the money Sergei Ivanovich had paid. Then he remembered how he had spent a night in a police station for disorderly conduct in the street. He remembered the shameful proceedings he had instituted against his brother, Sergei Ivanovich, accusing him of not having paid him, apparently, his share of his mother's estate. And the last scandal, when he had gone to a western province in an official capacity, and there had got into trouble for assaulting a village elder. It was all horribly vile, yet to Levin it appeared not at all as vile as it inevitably would to those who did not know Nikolai, did not know all his story, did not know his heart. Levin remembered that when Nikolai had been in the devout stage, the period of fasts and monks and church services, when he was seeking in religion a support and a curb for his passionate temperament, everyone, far from encouraging him, had jeered at him, and Levin had, too, with the others. They had teased him, calling him Noah and monk. Yet, when he had broken out, no one had helped him, but had all turned away from him with horror and loathing. Levin felt that Brother Nikolai, in spite of all the ugliness of his life, in his soul, in the very depths of his soul, was no more in the wrong than the people who despised him. He was not to blame for having been born with his unbridled character and some pressure upon his intellect, for he had always wanted to be good. I will tell him everything without reserve, and I will make him speak without reserve too, and I'll show him that I love him, and therefore understand him. Levin resolved to himself as, toward 11 o'clock, he reached the hotel, of which he had the address. At the top, 12 and 13, the porter answered Levin's inquiry. At home? Probably he is at home. The door of number 12 was half open, and together with a streak of light, there issued thick fumes of cheap, poor tobacco, and the sound of a voice, unknown to Levin, but he knew at once that his brother was there. He recognized his cough. As he went in at the door, the unknown voice was saying, "It all depends on how much judgment and knowledge the thing's done." Konstantin Levin looked in at the door and saw that the speaker was a young man with an immense shock of hair, wearing a Russian coat, and that a pockmarked young woman in a woolen gown, without collar or cuffs, was sitting on the sofa. His brother was not to be seen. Konstantin felt a sharp pang at his heart at the thought of the strange company in which his brother spent his life. No one had heard him, and Konstantin, taking off his galoshes, listened to what the gentleman in the Russian coat was saying. He was speaking of some enterprise. "Well, the devil flay them, these privileged classes," his brother's voice responded with a cough. "Masha, get us some supper and serve up some wine, if there's any left, or else send for some." The woman rose, came out from behind the partition, and saw Konstantin. "There's some gentleman here, Nikolai Dmitrievich," she said. "Whom do you want?" said the voice of Nikolai Levin angrily. "It's I," answered Konstantin Levin, coming forward into the light. "Who's I?" Nikolai's voice said again, still more angrily. He could be heard getting up hurriedly, stumbling against something, and Levin saw, facing him in the doorway, the big, scared eyes and the huge, gaunt, stooping figure of his brother, so familiar and yet astonishing in its oddity and sickliness. He was even thinner than 3 years before when Konstantin Levin had seen him last. He was wearing a short coat, and his hands and big bones seemed huger than ever. His hair had grown thinner, the same straight mustache hid his lips, the same eyes gazed strangely and naively at his visitor. "Ah, Kostya," he exclaimed suddenly, recognizing his brother, and his eyes lighted up with joy. But the same second he looked round at the young man and gave the nervous jerk of his head and neck that Konstantin knew so well, as if his cravat were choking him, and a quite different expression, wild, suffering, and cruel, rested on his emaciated face. "I wrote to you and Sergei Ivanovich both that I don't know you and don't want to know you. What is it you want?" He was not at all the same as Konstantin had been fancying him. The worst and most oppressive part of his character, which made all relations with him so difficult, had been forgotten by Konstantin Levin when he thought of him. And now when he saw his face, and especially that nervous twitching of his head, he remembered it all. "I didn't want to see you for anything," he answered timidly. "I've simply come to see you." His brother's timidity obviously softened Nikolai. His lips twitched. "Oh, so that's it," he said. "Well, come in. Sit down. Like some supper?" "Masha, bring supper for three." "No, stop a minute. Do you know who this is?" he said, addressing his brother and indicating the gentleman in the Russian coat. "This is Mr. Kritsky, a friend of my Kiev days, a very remarkable man. He's persecuted by the police, of course, since he's not a scoundrel." And he surveyed, as it was a habit of his, everyone in the room. Seeing that the woman standing in the doorway was starting to go, he shouted to her. "Wait a minute," I said. And with that inability to express himself, the incoherence that Konstantin knew so well, he began, with another look round at everyone, to tell Kritsky's story to his brother, how he had been expelled from the university for starting a benevolent society for the poor students and classes on Sunday, and how he had afterward been a teacher in a rural school and had been driven out of that too, and had afterward been on trial for something or other. "You're of the Kiev University," said Konstantin Levin to Kritsky, to break the awkward silence that followed. "Yes, I was in Kiev," Kritsky replied angrily, his face darkening. "And this woman," Nikolai Levin interrupted him, pointing to her, "is my life mate, Maria Nikolaevna. I took her out of a dive," and he jerked his neck as he said it. "But I love her and respect her, and anyone who wants to know me," he added, raising his voice and knitting his brows, "is requested to love and respect her. She's precisely the same as a wife to me, precisely. So now you know whom you've got to do with. And if you think you're lowering yourself, well, there's the door, and Godspeed thee." And again his eyes traveled inquiringly over all of them. "But how will I lower myself? I don't understand." "Then, Masha, tell them to bring supper, 3 portions, and vodka and wine." "No, wait a minute. No, it doesn't matter. Go ahead." Chapter 25. "So you see," pursued Nikolai Levin, painfully wrinkling his forehead and twitching. It was obviously difficult for him to think of what to say and do. "Here, do you see?" He pointed to some sort of short iron bars, fastened together with twine, lying in a corner of the room. "Do you see that? That's the beginning of a new enterprise we're going into. This enterprise will be an industrial association." Konstantin scarcely heard him. He looked into his sickly, consumptive face, and he was more and more sorry for him, and he could not force himself to listen to what his brother was telling him about the association. He saw that this association was a mere anchor to save him from self-contempt. Nikolai Levin went on talking. "You know that capital oppresses the worker. Our workers, the mushiks, bear all the burden of labor, and are so placed that, no matter how much they work, they can't escape from their position of beasts of burden. All the profits of labor on which they might improve their position and gain leisure for themselves, and after that education, All the surplus values are taken from them by the capitalists. And society is so constituted that the harder they work, the greater the profit of the merchants and landowners, while they stay beasts of burden to the end. And that state of things must be changed, he finished up, and looked questioningly at his brother. Yes, of course, said Constantine, looking at the patch of red that had come out on his brother's projecting cheekbones. And so we're founding a locksmith's association where all the production and profit and the chief instruments of production, everything will be in common. Where is the association to be? Said Constantine Levin. In the village of Vostrom, government of Kazan. But why in a village? In the villages, I think, there is plenty of work as it is. Why a locksmith's association in a village? Why? Because the peasants are just as much slaves as they ever were. And that's why you and Sergei Ivanovich don't like people to try and get them out of their slavery, said Nikolai Levin, exasperated by the objection. Constantine Levin sighed, looking meanwhile about the cheerless and dirty room. This sigh seemed to exasperate Nikolai still more. I know Sergei Ivanovich and your aristocratic views. I know that he applies all the power of his intellect to justify existing evils. I say, why do you talk of Sergei Ivanovich? Levin let drop, smiling. Sergei Ivanovich? I'll tell you why. Nikolai Levin shrank suddenly at the name of Sergei Ivanovich. I'll tell you why, but what's the use of talking? There's only one thing. What did you come to me for? You look down on all this. Very well, then. But go away, in God's name go away, he shrieked, getting up from his chair. Go away, go away. I don't look down on it at all, said Constantine Levin timidly. I don't even dispute it. At that instant, Maria Nikolaevna came back. Nikolai Levin looked around angrily at her. She went quickly to him and whispered something. It's not well. I've grown irritable, said Nikolai Levin, getting calmer and breathing painfully. And then you talk to me of Sergei Ivanovich and his essay. It's such rubbish, such lying, such self-deception. What can a man write about justice who knows nothing of it? Have you read his essay? He turned to Kritsky, sitting down again at the table and clearing a space for himself by pushing back some half-made cigarettes. I haven't, Kritsky responded gloomily, obviously not desiring to enter into the conversation. Why not? Said Nikolai Levin, now turning with exasperation upon Kritsky. Because I didn't see the use of wasting my time over it. Oh, if you please, how did you know it would be wasting your time? That essay is too deep for many people. That is to say, it's over their heads. But it's different with me. I see through his ideas, and I know wherein the essay's weakness lies. They all fell silent. Kritsky got up sluggishly and reached for his cap. Won't you have supper? All right, goodbye. Come round tomorrow with the locksmith. Kritsky had hardly gone out when Nikolai Levin smiled and winked. He too is poor stuff, he said, for I can see. But at that instant, Kritsky at the door called him. What do you want now, he said, and went out to him in the passage. Left alone with Maria Nikolaevna, Levin turned to her. Have you been long with my brother, he said to her. Yes, more than a year. His health has become very poor. He drinks a great deal. Just how? He drinks vodka, and it's bad for him. And a great deal, whispered Levin. Yes, she said, looking timidly toward the doorway, where Nikolai Levin had reappeared. What were you talking about, he said, knitting his brows and turning his scared eyes from one to the other. What was it? Oh, nothing, Constantine answered in confusion. Oh, if you don't want to say, don't, only it's no good you're talking to her. She's a wench, and you're a gentleman, he said with a jerk of the neck. You understand everything, I see, and have taken stock of everything, and look with commiseration on my transgressions. He began again, raising his voice. Nikolai Dmitrich, Nikolai Dmitrich, whispered Marianne Nikolaevna, again going up to him. Oh, very well, very well, but where's the supper? Ah, here it is, he said, seeing a waiter with a tray. Here, set it here, he added angrily, and promptly seizing the vodka, he poured out a pony and drank it greedily. Like a drink, he turned to his brother, and at once became better humored. Well, enough of Sergei Ivanovich. I'm glad to see you anyway. After all said and done, we're not strangers. Come, have a drink. Tell me what you're doing, he went on, greedily munching a piece of bread and pouring out another pony. How are things with you? I live alone in the country as I always have. I'm busy looking after the land, answered Constantine, watching with horror the greediness with which his brother ate and drank and trying to conceal that he noticed it. Why don't you get married? No opportunity has presented itself, Constantine answered, reddening. Why not? For me now, everything's at an end. I've made a mess of my life. But this I said, and I say still, that if my share had been given me when I needed it, my whole life would have been different. Constantine made haste to change the conversation. Do you know your little Vanya's with me? A clerk in the counting house at Pogrovskoe. Nikolai jerked his neck and sank into thought. Yes, tell me what's going on at Pogrovskoe. Is the house still standing and the birch trees and our schoolroom? And Philip the gardener, is he living? How I remember the summer house and the sofa. Now mind and don't alter anything in the house, but make haste and get married and make everything as it used to be again. Then I'll come and see you, if your wife is a fine woman. Why, come to me now, said Levin. How snugly we could settle down. I'd come and see you if I were sure I shouldn't find Sergei Ivanovich. You won't find him there. I live quite independently of him. Yes, but say what you like. You have to choose between him and me, he said, looking timidly into his brother's face. This timidity touched Constantine. If you want to hear my confession of faith on the subject, I tell you that in your quarrel with Sergei Ivanovich, I take neither side. You're both wrong. You're rather wrong outwardly, and he rather inwardly. Ah, you see that, Nikolai shouted joyfully. But I personally value friendly relations with you more because... Why? Constantine could not say that he valued it more because Nikolai was unhappy and needed affection. But Nikolai knew that this was just what he meant to say, and scowling, he took to the vodka again.